Hi, if I could take a moment of your time before we start, if you've enjoyed previous episodes or if you enjoy this episode, if you could subscribe on the platform that you listen to, that would be really helpful. It helps us get more guests and push the podcast forward. Thanks.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Nobody was doing it in for the DL Jeeps back in the days. So there was a real market opportunity there to build a brand around quality restorations of vintage Jeeps. So that became Jeep Heritage. And literally 7 years ago, took off two suitcases, a container with two cars to Texas, and yeah, started a new life.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Car Chat podcast. I'm Sam Moores, and with us today, we have Daniel Van Doveren. Hello.
Hey, Sam. How are you doing?
Hi. Can you tell the listeners a sort of short summary of who you are and what you do?
All right. So my name is Daniel Van Doveren, from Dutch and Swedish origins, and absolutely obsessed with building the best vintage Jeeps out there for a very select number of people. But the ultimate product, the ultimate Jeep product, basically. Yeah, we've got two companies. We started off with a more mild restoration company called Jeep Heritage. It's still around. It's classic nut and bolt restoration of mainly Jeep Wagoneers, Grand Wagoneers, trucks, Cherokees, CJs. We'll literally address anything from the early 40s all the way up to the early 90s. That's how it started off. Nice. And about 3 years ago, we launched Vigilante, which is basically the Vigilante version of that restoration process. Basically, going all in, loving the iconic design of the vehicle, just fed up of the constraints, the mechanical constraints from their original design. So we literally just re-engineered the heck out of everything that was outdated or that had some flaws from the past, from the original design, and made something very cool and unique.
And where did this all start from? Like, at what point in time did you start doing Jeep Heritage, and were you in the car industry before then? Talk to me about that.
Yeah. So I'm originally born and raised in Belgium, not far away from you. Swedish mother, Dutch father, educated in a very international environment. I've owned companies mainly in the tech industry since I'm 14 years old. Yeah. Overall, just always having worked and, basically lived to build something, right? Whether it's, software or tech or something else, it's always, it's always been in my DNA. Up until my 35th anniversary, I was involved in the tech industry. We had great success with a couple of companies back in Europe. that were basically designing security products for the for the physical security environment. Along that journey, partners, investors, all kinds of things that you don't plan for from the start. And at a certain point, it just became too much. And the Jeeps had always been my passion. They were always kind of my escape valve for the stress of the day. So since I'm 16, I've always been tinkering on Jeeps. I've never owned anything else than a Jeep. The fun part of it was that, the US was always an attraction and we were always kind of exploring the idea of making road trips with cheaper and cheaper cars. And so that's kind of how it started around the age of 18, just after getting a driver's license. I realized that, nobody would insure us if we'd rent a car out here in the US on a, on a journey for holiday or for business or whatever. So we always bought cars, and the challenge was basically get a cheaper and cheaper and cheaper car and make it from coast to coast in a successful way, full of adventures, obviously, very good memories. And this started off with maybe a once a year adventure and ended up in probably three, four times a year, lookout opportunity for the people that I cared for in back in Europe. So it really became an obsession. And of course, after at the end of those trips, you get emotional and you get your stories that are built in that car, and despite being the shittiest beater, you build up something that is unique. And of course, we end up putting the car in a container and saying, okay, well, let's plan a restoration and this and that. So that would be the second part of the journey. Once that car arrived in Europe, is literally five nights a week. And during the weekends, we just work on those cars with a select group of friends. And that's my story for a long time.
Nice. And were these all Jeeps, or was it a massive always variety Jeeps. Of just whatever you could get your hands on?
Always Jeeps. And I mean, I think I can say with high confidence that the most expensive Jeep we've ever bought on one of those trips is probably $5,000. The cheapest one we've driven across country with is probably just, $350, $400, $500, something like that. So totally crazy. There's tons of stories about those trips.
Yeah. Is there any particular most memorable moments or parts of one of those trips? Because I feel like there probably are quite a few.
Probably the most memorable one is we bought a car, a J10, a Jeep J10 from 1980 from a guy that claimed that he had bought this from James Brolin, famous actor and husband of Barbara Streisand. And he had apparently won this car in a desert race back in California, back in the days with the big boys. They were racing these cars. And it had a really special history. And we looked into that. And we did find a couple of articles on the internet about it. So we were really, really excited about this car. Took off with a buddy of mine.
That's cool.
The guy had agreed. I mean, this is probably 1999, 2000, something like that. The guy had said, okay, well, I'll pick you up at the airport. Obviously, we land and the guy's not there. Got to log into a little email in a cyber cafe and look into my email. I don't have time. Here's my address. Just meet me there. Well, we realized that, after a 14-hour flight, you got to rent a car. And we take off, arriving early evening at this guy's place. And literally he's sitting at his counter in his kitchen, And he barely turns around. I said, yeah, the car's out in the field, out there. Have you seen it? Yeah. And by the way, if you want to tailgate, it's $500 extra. And these are rare tailgates on those J10s. I don't know, whatever. Pay him the $500 extra. I mean, in the meantime, we're there with rental car that we have to go bring back and take off. We get insurance on the vehicle, start driving, and it gets really, really dark, right? So, yeah, my buddy behind me says, yeah, your taillights are not working. And I mean, the gauge cluster was not working. Nothing was working, right? We didn't know how much gas we had in there, and we were in the middle of Kentucky. Of course, the car dies, and we're just so tired and fed up, and we were going to camp through that whole trip. So we end up pushing the car on someone's property, which I've realized now that you don't do that, that easily in the U.S. And
yeah,
we did that and kind of found a spot where the car was kind of under some trees. And yeah, just pulled out our sleeping bags, lay down on the floor and fell asleep. And the next thing we remember is that there's this guy that's there with a rifle that's about, I mean, it's huge. And he's on our nose like this. What the fuck are you doing at my property? And us with our little European accents are like, okay, sorry, sir. You got it. Just broke down at this. Well, you got 10 minutes to get off my property. So that was like a 4:35 o'clock in the morning. Push it off down the road and then go get gas and so on and so on and so on. But that was the brutal waking up to the Kentucky welcome message, basically. And that car...
That's savage.
Yeah. That car, by the way, is still around here. It's actually parked here in the parking lot.
Oh, really? Nice.
Yeah, it's a really nice...
Oh, nice.
...original vehicle that now belongs to a friend of mine.
You're doing these trips... And then occasionally or always you're bringing the cars back home, working on them, fixing them up, etc. At what point in time did you start going, hey, I want to do this for someone else? And then presumably you moved to America at some point,
right?
In this process. So how did that come about?
Intentions were never to sell these cars. One of those J10s, I believe I was 18 when I got that, and it was finished, yeah, just before my 20s. Those are really rare cars. There's 1,264 of them made. And out there, back in the days, very low production. Yeah, I mean, it had no value, right? Not like any classic Porsche or whatever. I mean, literally, you could find them for really, really cheap and you could restore the heck out of it. And if you were get $20,000 back out of it after a serious restoration, you'd be considered lucky, right? The bigger ones, the ones that were catching a little more money were the Wagoneers and the Grand Wagoneer, but the trucks definitely not. Anyhow, I finished that car. I drove it with lots of pride through Belgium and, on a daily basis. And so there's a couple of pictures on the internet that the CEO of Jeep Europe happened to find. He contacted me and he said, look, this is so beautiful what you've done. Can I come and see the vehicle? I said, yeah, sure. Come around and we'll have a chat. And it was maybe there was other business opportunities to develop with them as a brand and so on and so on. So I just welcomed it. Guy shows up, super nice, takes the Eurostar or the Thales, I don't remember, go pick him up in Brussels. With the vehicle, we sit down, we go for a ride, and he says, I know it's not for sale, but everything has a price. I need this car for in the showroom, and we're going to do road tours with it and this and that. And he's having all these crazy ideas with the car. So I told you, I mean, I just put probably 2 years of my life in this car and absolutely not intend on selling it. Yeah, he just keeps on pushing a number up and up and up and up. And at a certain point, you're like, you know what, how far is he going to go, right? And in the meantime, I'm like, okay, well, I can do another one of those for what he's offering me. Yeah. I can put a down payment on a house with that money because I was still living with my parents.
Yeah.
So yeah, at a certain point, I just crack and tell him, okay, well, let's do it. So that was the first, my first kind of connection with doing this, not for myself only as a hobby, but for someone else. So we agreed to the sale.
That is a really cool first customer.
Yeah. And we agreed to the sale and I found another one, obviously went through the whole process again. And the same thing happened again, but with an Italian collector. And he contacted me. He said, look, nice. I've been trying to connect to restore this vehicle. He had one that he had bought, but there was just nobody was really knowledgeable for those vehicles back in Italy. Yeah, and it was difficult to get the job done properly. So he said, look, why don't we trade and I'll give you a chunk of money and, you know, you can do your third one basically. So copy paste, history repeats itself. So yeah, I'm like, oh, maybe I should buy all these J10s, you know, and build a market around it. Yeah. I mean, I've probably owned 10 of them over my life. But you know, as things evolved, those trips just kept on coming. We were traveling around the US and there was probably 30 or 40 cars out there that we had brought back and not enough hands to get them restored and also not enough money to get them restored because I mean, they're expensive undertakings.
Yeah.
Even if you put all your sweat equity in there yourself. So yeah, that was kind of the start. And at a certain point, yeah, you end up with all these cars and you also realize that there's only 7 days in a week. And, you know, once you pass that seven car rotation where you can say Monday, I take one Jeep, Tuesday, I take another Jeep, Thursday, and so on and so on. But once you pass those, that one car a day routine, it's not very fun anymore because the reality of it is also that you can restore the heck out of them and you're still dealing with the old mechanical interface that has its limits.
Yeah.
And if you don't drive an old car for a certain amount of time, you leave it sitting for 20 or 30 days. Fortunately, that rear main seal is always going to leak. That's just the nature of how that setup was designed. There was, at the same time you were building up that collection, there was a lot of frustration from, you know, it really overtook your life, right? You didn't have a spare minute of doing anything else than taking care of old cars for a collection, that you were proud of, but that's not your life, you know, there's more to it than that. Fast forward a couple of years later, the dream of coming to the US was always there and you only have one life, right? So I built up a business plan to move over to the US, start paying the proper attention, just like we would have done back in Europe, to these cars, because nobody was doing it for the old Jeeps back in the days. It was always the Toyotas, the Broncos that got the right attention, and there were serious companies that had put the efforts into those brands. But for these old Jeeps, it wasn't the case. So there was a real market opportunity there to step in and to build a brand around quality restorations of vintage Jeeps. So that became Jeep Heritage. And literally 7 years ago, took off two suitcases, a mountain bike, a Bluetooth speaker, and a container with two cars to Texas. And started a new life. Found a place to rent.
Wow.
Had a fantastic landlord that was really nice and just let us geek out on in a building that he owned that was an old Ford dealership in a little town called Columbus, Texas, which is in the middle of nowhere. But that was part of the charm, right?
At that point in time, so you got two cars and you're starting building them. And were you trying to get customers first, or were you building the cars and then selling them
so
afterwards?
the model was very, it was phased, right? First of all, of course, I mean, I didn't have massive financial inputs in the back to start building 10 cars and just having them in a parking lot.
Yeah.
Those were rough days, to be honest with you, because it's just, it didn't happen overnight. Let's put it that way. So what I had, I put out, started out with two cars, and I brought a couple of more from Belgium. Then I sold the whole thing in Belgium, to collectors in Europe. So we started off with, a couple of cars and just putting out the name and describing the process really well, like what we're going to do. We're going to take the vehicles all the way down to the bare metal. We're going to take it down to the chassis and make sure that the chassis is structurally in good condition. That we're going to zinc prime that chassis, and we're going to powder coat it. And we're going to do this all in a very respectful way, just the way that you would do it on any other old vehicle that has market value. So we did that, and we did get good market traction for it. We got the lovers and the haters. Of course, the lovers stepped in with us, and we started filling out in the order book, and the haters were saying, "Oh, you're completely crazy. I mean, those cars were what, $140,000-$150,000 back in the days, and you know, probably the most expensive one that you would have found out on Bring a Trailer or whatever, it was going to be maybe $50,000 or $60,000. But it was not a full restoration the way that we were to do it. So you either understood it and you'd understand that you'd build a vehicle that would last for another 30 years and that would get totally revisited, or you didn't get it. And then, we're wasting our time with you. That's kind of how we built it up. I started also, the hard thing about coming to a new country and you don't know with whom to work. You start learning about how you pay people, who's a good worker, who's not a good worker. It's very different from Europe, where I'm used to the European model, where, you hire someone for the long term. And if you really got to separate, it has massive consequences. What you have to pay them and how long they have to stay and so on and so on.
Yeah.
In the US, it's just like push a block, right? You can do that.
Really?
Yeah, it's crazy. So, but that has implications also that, if people find a job that they make $1 more per hour down the street, they will really consider it. And so you really have to create value in building up a team that, that believes in you and that wants to follow you. And in the beginning, that was a little hard, but right now we have a really good team that's been with us for, say, some of the guys have been with us for more than 5 years. That's good.
Where you started, was there a reasonable pool of people with the skills in your area?
We were right between Houston, Austin, San Antonio. If you were driving in each direction about an hour, you'd get to the suburbs, those three big cities. So, I mean, the people that were interested in this field of work, they would do the drive. I used to live, I met my wife in Houston as well. So I used to live in Houston. So I do the drive out there for many years. I've done that. It's just part of, Texas is so big. You just got to accept that you can't find a job just down the road where you're going to be walking distance. That's just not something that's an option out here. Everything gets done by car, and that's just a very different reality. So we did manage to get a team together. And right now we have a really solid one. And people that we can start, going out on vacations and being, comfortable with that, which in the beginning you would absolutely not do because you had to always supervise everything. And it was just. It was a risk factor involved.
Yeah, totally. So you're doing these restorations, and did you have to sort of pick the level of restoration that you were doing as such? Because the finished price is, I presume it's got to come out roughly around a certain number.
Correct.
And do you go, did you have to sort of like decide what level to do, or actually just doing these kind of properly, in inverted commas, just came out at this price and that was okay?
Everything starts up with a discussion with the client, right? What's your story? What are you going to use the vehicle with? Has this vehicle been in your family forever? So, you know, if that's the case, then they know the mechanical interface and they know what the limitations are, and they are comfortable with, you know, a steering wheel that's going to turn a little bit before you really have some reaction on the road. I mean, that's just all part of the original charm of the vehicle, right? If you had someone that just had seen a Wagoneer in a magazine and they said, okay, I want to have a Wagoneer, I want to, you know, I want my wife to drive in it. Then you need to dig deeper into the conversation and understand, you know, what are you going to do? Is this going to be a daily driver? Is this going to be, something that is just weekend use? Yeah, it becomes a very different process. And along the way, my wife also started having, some serious thoughts and some serious, she loved the cars because we were all always driving in these vehicles. But she was getting a little annoyed with the fact that, you know, you go out to a remote area and, you know, your fuel gauge isn't really 100% right. So, you know, you got to prepare for it. And, you know, so we ended up, or she ended up on the side of the road a couple of times just because, it's an old car. That's it. And it's built the old school way.
Yeah.
So from that, we started just before COVID, we started in 2019, really saying, hey, look, we've done all these classic restorations. We have a following. I think it's time that we bring it to the next level, right? There is, we saw with other brands, we saw what was happening with the Broncos, with the FJs, with the Scouts. We saw that there was, even with the Porsches, with Singer, for instance, that there was love for these old cars, but there was no patience for dealing with the downside of the traditional mechanical interface, right? And we those Jeep Heritage restorations, we had offered a couple of upgrades. So there was fuel injection available. There was a little bit of better braking available.
We started it,
but that has its limits, right? Because sure, your car will start right up every time if you fuel inject it, but you're still dealing with a chassis that is, you know, old school suspension, basically a buggy suspension under it. Nothing to do with the car that we're building right now for like Vigilante, right? So at a certain point, you get to the limitations of that. And we're both looking at each other, Rachel and I, and saying, hey, I think it's the right moment. It's not $150,000 anymore. It's double that, sometimes more than that. But it is literally just the shell of the vehicle that we maintain, the body and the interior that gets restored in a traditional way. And all the rest has been 100% revisited to modern standards. And that's not only for the drivetrain, but that's also for the comfort level inside the vehicle, the materials. We'll dive into that in a second, I'm sure. That's the start of the story. From there, what we did was pick three models that were, you know, that we had the most affection with. The Wagoneer, which had this massive following, the Cherokee, which is the two or four door, I like to call it the big brother of the Wagoneer, and the trucks, the J trucks. So those are basically the three models that we started off with. We started off with 3D scanning the full bodies of these vehicles so that we could have them in CAD. That gave a base to, you know, developing something around it. So with the models in CAD, we were able to define, okay, how do you want to see the stance of the vehicle? How do you want to see, what drivetrain do you want to see in there? And with 3D scanning technologies, you can literally just get everything in CAD and build around it. So that's how it started.
Yeah.
In terms of drivetrains, we said, okay, we got to stay true with the DNA of the brand, Jeep being part of the kind of the Dodge family, Dodge Chrysler, Stellantis family. We said, okay, we're going to use the modern Hemis, and those finally became available as crate engines, as crate components for people like us that do this, are able now to drop in every single Hemi model that's out there under the hood without doing any body modifications. That was really, really important to us, that we don't start chopping up firewalls and becoming that custom, you know, that custom shop, that fabrication shop that's out there that, that basically builds beautiful cars, but they're always one-offs. It was really important that we could get to a point where, we could replicate this, because scale the model, make it more efficient, and also make sure that it's serviceable at the level where the car doesn't always need to come back to us for serviceability, right?
Yeah.
So all these thoughts and all these ideas came into our head, and that kind of built the base for Vigilante. It took about a year to get that started, to get that all in line. Other than looking into the drivetrains, we said, okay, well, the drivetrain is one thing, but with more power, you need more brakes, right? With more brakes, well, you have bigger calipers and bigger discs. Well, unfortunately, you got to make bigger wheels. So what happens is we basically 3D scanned the wheels, kept their original design, and just increased the diameter for us to allow those big brakes to sit under there. Suspension-wise and stance-wise, the vehicle could, you know, often in so many cases, you lift a vehicle and it just doesn't look right with the proportions, right? You lift it and then it looks too skinny from the back, or the wheels come out of it, or it just doesn't look right. So it really took a lot of effort to fine tune that, to finding that right combination, that right, you know, aspect ratio between the rest of the vehicle, the tires, how you fill in those wheel wells, move the wheels or the axle into that wheel well so that it would look centered and nicer than what it originally looked like. Then from there, just to dive into every single aspect of the vehicle that had failed on us on all these road trips and all these, you know, door handles that stay jammed into play or that don't open up, mirrors that whenever you shut the door would just fall out because of their bad designs from, you know, their bad original design, right? Jeep really has a name for it out there, but one thing that it's never been is a quality product. It's always been that brand has been moved from one company to the other and has literally saved all the other brands around it because, it was always the success brand along that conglomerate of Jeep, Chrysler, Plymouth, and so on and so on.
Yeah.
They also, because of it moving from AMC to Chrysler and so on and so on and so on, they were always there with financial constraints and making, not so good products, to be honest with you. So we really revisited everything that had failed on us during all those years. Said, okay, well, if we can make wheels, we can also make mirrors that don't fall whenever you shut the doors. We can make doors that seal.
Yeah.
We can make, and those old Grand Wagoneers, usually they were claiming that they were leather, but only the center portion of the seat was leather and everything else around it was vinyl just to cheap out on materials, you know? So
yeah,
when we redo this, it's full leather, it's full, you know, there's full new backing, powder coated frames, the whole nine yards, new springs. It just, it's just a very deep approach to understanding the past and making a better product that we can put into the hands of our clients. that's about it.
And when you were going through this process of getting the, you know, the stance right and all that stuff, presumably were you doing a lot of that in CAD and then occasionally testing it out? Like, could you do a lot of that in CAD and then when you put it on a car, you're like, that's pretty close to where we want it?
In 99% of the cases, it's always good once we have it in CAD. The times that we run into, you know, into question marks still is that Jeep, since I was telling you that it passed from one company to another for such a long time, there is some variations between like an early model Wagoneer, a mid-70s model Wagoneer, and a late model Grand Wagoneer. Despite it being the same shell and the same proportions and so on, there's just areas where, you know, fittings don't sit in the same position and so on and so on. And we're still discovering a little bit of that. But other than that, I mean, that's also something that really motivated us into doing that in 2019, is that the technology just became available to people like us in a very different way than it used to be 5 years ago or 10 years ago. It wouldn't have been possible 10 years ago. The whole reverse engineering aspect of it, it's just not possible, you know. Anything we do, we can 3D print in a couple of hours, and we can just test fit it before really putting it into production. That was not possible 10 years ago, unless, you know, you had massive investments in massive 3D printers that were you know, that would cost tens of thousands of dollars. Now we can do that with, you know, smaller devices that run way more efficiently, and that we can just do it, you know, in house.
Yeah. So do you have like I've seen a video once of this sort of crazy laser hand scanner type thing. Do you have something like that that you use to scan parts?
So you scan it. You can scan, basically it takes it out of the shape of the object that you're scanning, and you get that into a vectorial file in CAD, and then you can manipulate it. You can use that as a base, basically. That's really handy. We have to use that at least once a month on some new application.
And has that been like, because did you have an idea of roughly how many, did you say when you started going, okay, we're going to do these, actually it's going to take us ages to get the chassis right, we're going to have to tweak the door handles, the mirror, like all this sort of stuff. We're going to have to do all this work. In your head, were you like, okay, we kind of want to do at least 20 or whatever cars, because then you've got to set a price and all that sort of stuff? Or how did that bit work out?
Well, that's pretty, you know, there's still functionality that we add. Like on the later models now, we're adding climate control to the back area of the Wagoneers, which was never available. The AC systems in those cars had so much opportunity for improvement that we said, okay, well, we're not only going to make it colder and blow more in your face or wherever, you know, in the area in the front, but we're also going to bring it to the back seats. Why not? You know, we can do that nowadays. That's stuff that we've started adding, and from day one, it was a success, just because you are able to validate that and to do that in house, basically, in order to achieve the functionality. On suspension wise, that is also that's chassis wise, we were good from the start. The selection of the axles, it's Dana 60 in the back, Dana 44 in the front. Those are long term, really high standard axles that have proven themselves, year over year, right? Really what we had to work on is weight ratio, on the distribution of weight, on the comfort level, and also on how people are using their vehicles. It's a very different usability for someone who orders a truck and who's gonna now and then take his buddy or his son with him and is just gonna want to go down the strip and with a six-gear manual, versus someone who's going to take the car out with his family and bring it to the beach and occasionally go on some sand, and that's going to be it. The rest of it is going to be highway cruising, right? So that discussion, that initial discussion that we have with clients is really, really important for them to, yeah, for us all to understand what's going to be the key to successfully delivering that vehicle to them.
Yeah, because I can imagine you probably had a lot of customers, and you'll be able to tell me that, and you mentioned it a bit originally, who look at the car. Like, I look at like a Grand Wagoneer, and I look at that and go, that looks like a really comfy, quite cool family wagon type thing, but I've never driven an original. I've definitely never driven an old one. I kind of fancy one of those for just like going around day to day.
Right.
And then you're like, okay, well, hang on. Maybe you should drive an original just to get an idea of what we're talking about here. Right. And then how far do the new builds or your Vigilante builds sit from an original of the base it's coming? Like,
it is.
Are they still the same, or is it like it's just completely different?
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
It is 100% different. It is such different driving experience. It is tight on the road. If you want to drive 100 miles per hour, you can do that, which you could not do in the original vehicle. It brakes like a modern car. It will really, I mean, you'll feel your guts being pulled forward whenever you're braking.
And you're not like
even, I mean,
wobbling around.
Yeah, that's right. And the base package that we offer is with a SRT8, 485 horsepower, 6.4 liter, which is an engine that's been found in so many muscle cars from the Dodge brand. You've seen them in Grand Cherokees, you've seen them in Durangos, you've seen them in such a variety of vehicles, and it's a great it's a great selection for whoever's going to drive this as a family vehicle, right? It's a lot of power. It's way more power than the 165 horsepower that the original Grand Wagoneer had. But it's still, you know, you could literally lend this car out to your 20-year-old son or 18-year-old son and not be worried at night that, you know, that they do something stupid with it.
Yeah.
Hellcat Red Eye, that's a very different level.
Go up
level
to the Hellcat. Do you do Demon? Is that the most powerful one, or is there one above that now?
So we've got a couple of ones that are immediately available. That are the traditional Hellcat is 707 horsepower. We've got the Hellcat Red Eyes absolutely. The Hellcat Red Eye came out as a nice little variation, 810 horsepower. Great, fine, but don't give that over to your kids, right? We have one with a prefix 9-liter Dodge Viper V10 crate engine that got bored out, which is 860 horsepower right now. That's in the build in the shop. It's ridiculous power.
1 mpg.
Not gonna comment on that. But
well, we know it's going to be low.
It's not good for London streets, no, for sure not.
Yeah, or long distance. Is it? Are those cars 4-wheel drive?
Yes, always.
Are they rear-wheel drive?
Again, we really wanted to maintain a lot of these, you know, rest mod companies or custom shops would basically put the body of these Wagoneers on like a C10 chassis and basically get something that's a little bit more modern, but would eliminate the four-wheel drive capability of it just because there was no space and so on and so on. Part-time four-wheel drive, two-wheel drive, four-wheel drive high, four-wheel drive low. It's an Atlas 2 twin stick transfer case that sits in there, super strong, built for, you know, for high horsepower. Most people will drive it two-wheel drive and then shift into four if needed. But you are able to drive in four-wheel drive as well full-time if you wanted to.
What's your most sort of popular spec and engine choice and stuff like that? And do you offer air suspension? Is that an option?
We don't have air suspension. It's all four-link coil suspension. We are playing around a lot with the selection of those springs, those coils, for in function of the usability, right? So that's really something that gets dialed in for the client. It also limits the way that these vehicles always sit a little bit higher than the original vehicle, just because of that suspension setup. That's just something that we are limited with. I think it looks way cooler this way, but some people would like to, you know, this, you know, would like to see it a little bit lower, but we offer power steps for that crowd. That kind of becomes a new standard here in 2024 as well.
So
retractable power steps, whenever you open the door, they just slide out and come back in, tuck under there very discreetly, but no airbags.
And what's the most popular spec? Like, what are most people, do you get a lot of people that, something I've seen with other builders is like, people start the project and go, well, obviously I'm going to have the red eye engine and the sportiest everything.
Yeah.
And then actually after you've really dig down, like what you're going to use it for, like, do you really want that? And then they come back down. Like where do most people sort of settle?
392 is the one that we see in most builds. And funny enough, there has been really a convergence into the manual transmissions. So we offer these cars with either Bowler 4-speed automatic transmission that's built specifically for these, for the horsepower that you put in back. Great, great, great product. Or a 6-speed manual. And the 6-speed manual is a Tremec transmission that you can find back in a lot of the modern muscle cars. Really short shift, really fun to play with. So most of the time people have these vehicles as a secondary vehicle, and you know, they have their automatics and their Teslas for everyday use. And when they step into these during the weekends, they want to have fun, you know, they want to shift through the gears have a more tactile experience than what they'll get out of their Tesla or whatever other vehicle that they drive, right? Also very fun for us to see, very fun for my wife to see, because I think she really has a role in that to play, is that the female audience has really grown on us. And you know, we have probably 40% of our clientele is female based. So that's a big change for the classic restorations, where you know, the classic restoration would be maybe 5 or 10% of female clientele. Just because they get it and they are, you know, they want to have a cool ride. That's not a G-Wagon, or that's not a Range Rover, or that's not, you know, one of the, you know, they've probably owned 5 generations of each one of those, and they now want to have something that stands out and that's a little different. So it's really fun to build for these ladies and get their feedback on that too. That's awesome.
That's cool. Cause I've not, if I imagine, if I sort of polled most of the people I've interviewed, it would be a very low number.
Right.
But that's, yeah, that's cool. And do you typically see a different type of build for a lady or not really?
Comfort's got to be important, right? That's definitely got to be an important factor. The high horsepower stuff is not playing an important role in their decision. Comfort, serviceability. So each of these cars you can literally drive into any of the Jeep dealerships or Mopar dealerships anywhere in the world.
Oh, nice.
And they can service these cars. There is full build sheets. There's a QR code in the glove box that they can scan, and they have every single part number of whatever is on this vehicle that they can just scan a reference to. So yeah, that's really, really important to us because we don't know where these cars go. We just build them so that they can be self-maintained, and also that, you know, durability is really, really important to us. Whether a car stays here in Texas, goes to California, we apply the same rust treatments and the same rust prevention methods onto a car that's going to see sunshine all day long or that's going to sit, you know, in a rainy Belgium for the next 10, 15 years. That's really, really important to us.
It must be quite interesting if you work in one of these dealerships and one of your build rolls in, like a Hellcat engine in it or whatever. Have you had photos from people that work in dealerships of one of your cars?
We've had a couple of dealerships show interest in these vehicles for themselves just to have, you know, in the showroom and so on. But yeah, clients themselves, no. It's too young of an undertaking as well. I mean, literally, our capacity today is 8 cars a year. We're beefing that up to 12 cars a year, which is already quite a number. But I don't want to go over that. The reason for that is I decided to do this. I want to have fun every day. I want to be involved. I want to have my hands in there. I don't want to be a manager of a manager of a manager. I've done that for 35 years in my previous life. And absolutely have learned a lot from it, but do not want to sit behind a computer all day long. That limits the, also team-wise, I know that, you know, the sweet spot is like, you know, once you start going over 15 in your team, it's not funny. It's just, so we're right under there and that's fine. And if we can build 12 cars next year instead of 8, great, wonderful. That's the plan.
That's an interesting attitude to see. And I totally understand that, like 100%. I'm the same with the production of this podcast. Like there's like, I don't want very many people involved because I like everyone being involved and staying doing it. I don't want to be managing 50 people or whatever. I don't think we would ever get to that point. But it's quite cool to see a company go, you know what? Actually, we love what we do. We do it as best as we can do it. We do it very well. But actually, there's only going to be 12 a year. And probably for your customers, that's pretty cool as well.
Yeah. And it's so important, you know, that people feel that in the cars that we produce, that there is love and that there is emotions put in thousands of hours of hard labor and work and good intentions from everyone involved in the process of getting that product out there. You can't imagine. I mean, people, it's really emotional once a car gets out of here and you've worked on it for over 12 months. Yeah, you get quite emotional. But it's also fun to stay in touch with the people. And yeah, we have such positive and fun reactions from people that, you know, are driving these cars out or bring them to the Cars and Coffee, and they get more attention than whatever Lambo that's out there. And, you know, just a crowd of people around them just because it's so special. I think that's, of course, as a financial aspect or as a business aspect to it, sure, we're never going to get super rich by doing this, but we're going to have fun, and we're going to have fun every day in a beautiful environment with a great team, a fantastic team. Yeah, we're going to take pride in what we do, and that's way more important to us than, you know, having a bank account that's just overfull and that you don't know what to do with it anymore. So yeah, that's kind of the vision. Also, client wise, I think that it's really important that we, you know, each car is basically a rolling work of art. We don't want to standardize things on, you know, there's some of these companies out there that are basically just offering a catalog of, okay, you can choose these paint jobs outside and you can choose from these, you know, five sets of interiors and you pick your wheels and it's going to be a soft top or a hard top. And yeah, okay, place your order. That's basically it, right? We don't want that. It's got to be a very personal vehicle that someone is going to want to hold on to for the next 30 years or 20 years and then pass on to their son because it was built with that ruggedness and that quality and with pride. And yeah, there's that's really our clientele, right? People that get that, great. People that say, hey, call me up and say, oh, what you got in stock? I don't have anything in stock. I got 50 donor vehicles we can start with and, you know, build your dream Jeep with, but it's going to take time. It's going to take money. It's going to take effort. And it's going to take your implication into defining what you expect from us. We don't just build something that's whatever product that's out there. And you see, like in the Bronco world, you clearly see that happening more and more there, that, you know, Broncos are hot and some streets in some neighborhoods, in some wealthy neighborhoods, sometimes you'll see, you know, two or three of the same Broncos, you know, from house to house, the same Britney blue color or whatever color it's going to be. That's, you know, it's not fun. You know, that's very far away from what we want to do.
It's funny now how you can get, we've got all these companies, like various companies doing resto mods and whatever, and different builds of different stuff. And so many kind of bespoke or reasonably bespoke cool projects. And then you just go, like, if you're in Europe, if you went to like one of the like quite cool events, you'd see like all of this stuff and you're like, they're all here.
Yeah, right.
Like, you've all got one off bespoke cars.
How do you see the scene in Europe evolving for the classic cars and the rest of mod world? Is there room for that
I think so. I think it's more popular now than ever. And I think your point about people like the look and the aesthetics of an old car. But like, if you're used to modern cars and if you're coming into this from a sort of modern point where you're looking at cars that are older than you or like older than your sort of real memory, I think a lot of people go, I want to own that, but I don't want to drive the reality.
Right.
I want some mod cons and stuff. And I've been through this a little bit. I had a backdated 911, which was an SC that was sort of that was resto modded. And even that level, it didn't have direct injection or anything like that. That was about right, but it was still probably not quite as rugged as I would have liked. I like to be able to just get in, drive, get on with your life and do that stuff.
Yeah.
I don't really have time for breaking down. That car never broken down, but I see it. I think it's just going to get more and more and more popular.
Right. And how does regulation, I've left the continent for 7 years now, but one of the reasons why I decided to do this out here and not in Europe is that, regulation was just so hard on anything outside of the standard norms, that was just not an option. But we do have a couple of clients now that have vehicles in the builds that will go back to Europe. So I figured it, you know, it's easier than what it used to be.
Yeah. What do you see? Do you see increased demand in your area for these sorts of things?
Well, I mean, we build. There's only a few that stay around Texas, to be honest with you. Most of it is just going. I mean, it's going everywhere. It's going back to Europe. It's going to, got stuff going to Hawaii. We've got stuff. It's really all over the place. So yeah, the chances of us seeing the vehicle again, you know, here in the neighborhood or whatever, it's fairly limited.
Have you? Have you ever thought of, I don't know whether anyone would be interested or not, going and redoing like one of your original road trips, but with a set of customers and going, hey, I want to, let's do coast to coast with a bunch of our cars.
So I would love to, but I mean, not in the old clumsy stuff, right? We used to do that, Rachel and I back in the days, but yeah, with the clients, yeah, I rarely get to meet the clients, to be honest with you. We have a lot of email conversation and phone calls, but now and then we just, you know, whatever we need a break, we just deliver personally, but that rarely happens, maybe once a year.
Yeah.
If we're lucky, but what we do try to do is that basically every vehicle before delivering, we put about 1500 miles on it just for testability. Everything needs to be retorqued after a certain point. We just, you know, in order for us to make sure that it's 100%, we have to have those test miles. If we don't do that, I know, I mean, people that claim that they can just sell a car with 50 miles on there and it'd be impeccable. I mean, that's horseshit. It's impossible because there are going to be so many flaws. You can streamline your process so well. They're still fully custom built vehicles, right? So you want to get rid of all the little noises and the squeaks and the this and the that. Every car that we build, we try to, when we're lucky, bring them out. We're about 5 hours away from Big Bend National Park, which is the most pristine, incredible place, I think, in the U.S. Very remote location, incredible roads, always sunshine. You get a mix of, you know, highway where you can, you know, geek out because there's really nobody. And then, dirt roads, but more mountain roads and so on. So you can flex suspension a little bit and make sure everything just sits tight and fits tight. So that's kind of our pleasure moment that before every car leaves. Other than that, it's just regular traditional test miles here in the area.
Yeah, yeah. That makes so much sense. Like with new car, you know, you buy a new car. I got a new car recently and you get it with like 5 miles on it or whatever it is, like not very many miles.
Really?
And then the first couple of weeks is when you find any issues, like, you know, stuff that's not quite fit correctly and like needs tweaking and et cetera. And actually, I'd rather someone else did those 50 miles, 100 miles, 200 miles, some running in, do the engine, all that stuff. And then when I get it, it's like, I can just get on with my life. I don't want to go back to the dealership.
Yeah. But the OEMs have a lot of machinery that we don't have, obviously, right? That's why we have to put so many more. Yeah. But yeah, definitely they should. I mean, all those Hellcat motors, they get run, remember how much, but they get run quite a bit. Whenever we get them, they have dirty oil in there just because they've been ran on the dyno for a couple of hours each. I don't remember the exact mileage, but I'm sure we can look into it. So engine-wise, that's already been, that's already a great thing. Suspension-wise, your panels, your fitments, sometimes there'll be a little cable that needs to be zip-tied inside, under a door card or whatever it is. There's always some little noises here and there. And you can put all the attention in the world into it. To get it 100% right from, the very first time, it never happens. And people that will tell you that, they're pure fools.
Yeah. Have you, if someone was going to do a wrestling mod project or some sort of cheap one, is there any advice you'd give to people that are thinking of doing it? Not necessarily as a company, but as an individual, as a customer.
Yeah, more is not always better. A lot of times you see people dropping in, high horsepower engines on, stock chassis that are absolutely not made for that, right? That just becomes a real danger zone. Used to have a scrambler that had stock chassis I'd bought back in the days when I was really young, nearly 500 horsepower under the hood. I mean, the amount of times that chassis cracked just because of having too much power on that stock chassis was ridiculous. And so, you know, sometimes you're better off just saying, hey, man, I'm gonna build something that's really reliable and that's really going to be fun to drive, but with half the horsepower. It's still double than what it used to be, right?
What it had.
What it had. Yeah. Axle-wise, same story. Yeah, you just have limitations on the stock interface. There's two aspects that get so neglected in the restoration world is safety, first of all. You can have high horsepower, but you really got to consider safety. That's something that I invite anybody to really look into. So whether it's braking or seatbelts, modern seatbelts. I mean, I love the look of an old seatbelt, but a modern seatbelt is just so much better than what they used to make it back in the 70s or the 60s or whatever. The fuel lines, you know, people using old brittle fuel lines or leaving old brittle fuel lines under the hood. You know, they're going to have everything shiny, every bolt shiny. But, you know, sometimes you see those cars with like 15-year-old fuel lines on there. I mean, that's just big hazard, right? Yeah. And then don't underestimate wiring, because the same thing with wiring, you know, wires get old and they get brittle, and, you know, they are main cause for fires under the hood and so on. So on any of these vehicles, whether it's classic restoration or whether it's a vigilante, there's not an inch of old wire on these vehicles. It is fully rebuilt from the ground up, so that you can respect the safety norms that we want to apply to this.
Well, I normally wrap these up with five questions. Are you ready?
I'm always ready.
Do you have a most memorable driving trip or journey?
This, it's so hard to define, because, you know, as you get older, we now have a 4-year-old son, and we try to have him participate in all these road trips. I probably, those are the best ones, right? Just going off with him, with my wife, Rachel, taking off to Big Bend, not having any iPads with, you know, whatever that he needs to look at. No, just having a 5-hour drive as a family, looking at the beautiful mountains, looking at the scenery in that big glass bowl of a Wagoneer or a Cherokee. Those are probably the best moments. I'd probably stick to that. And we've done that fairly recently with a couple of vehicles. And it's crazy, because kids in modern cars, the first thing they do, because there's so much darkness and spots from, you know, the all these beams around and safety. Your lookout opportunity is so much smaller versus this Wagoneer or this Cherokee, which literally has a couple of pillars left and right, and the rest is just glass, you know? So he rarely takes on an iPad or a phone in a Wagoneer or a Cherokee, versus whenever we take a modern car, it's like, okay, first thing you got to hand over is not good.
Yeah.
So
that's so true. I've not really thought about that, but I've definitely experienced it when you're in an older car, like my old 911 when I had that. You can just look around and you're like, oh, the wing mirrors don't work that great. Yep. But actually, if I just turn around, I can see.
I can actually see
what I'm looking for.
Yeah.
Then the experience of driving through cool scenery, et cetera, is, you're much more sort of in it.
I have a rule that I'm starting to apply, because flying is just not fun anymore. So the rule is very simple. As long as you can reach it by car on the same continent in the US, I refuse to step on a flight. I just, you know, it's so important at 4 years old as well. You know, if we go from here to Colorado, it's beautiful. It's beautiful. It's 18 hours of beautiful scenery. There's no reason to step on a flight. You know, you're going to save a couple of hours, but so what? Who cares?
Yeah. And just enjoy doing it, the journey.
Yeah, and having the bond, father and son bond, or mother and son bond, and just being as family together without, Yeah, before you get back home and you have to sit in front of TV again and this and that, just like, those are the good moments.
Yeah. I've not done a good road trip with my son yet. He's two.
All right.
And I'm looking forward to it. I'm looking forward to it. If you could only drive one car for the rest of your life, I normally say sports car, but yeah. What would it be?
So usually I get the question answered in a different way. It's usually like, what do you care about? You know, if you got to choose one car that you want to own, which one is it going to be? And the reality is I don't want to own anything anymore. I mean, we get the experience of driving, you know, 8 to 10 cars a year, different ones that need to be test driven. So I don't care about collecting cars. I don't care about owning them. It's a different experience every time, right? Now, what I'm looking the most forward to, and that's because we have a family connection with that vehicle. My father used to own one. Rachel loves that car. My son loves the car, and we have one in the building, the shop. Is a 77 Cherokee Chief, red. It's got a Hellcat red eye under the hood, a 6-speed manual. That's the one that if I were to build that car for myself, that would probably be the key.
Nice. That's an interesting take on the question, because the question is technically, if you can only drive one car, what's it going to be? So it's not necessarily connected to ownership, but I'm totally with you on that. I've been through owning a few cars. I think at one point I had 6. Mm-hmm. And I'm very much now like, I want to own less cars. Like, I love experiencing other people's cars. That's amazing.
Yeah.
I love experiencing different vehicles and whatever. But just pure ownership of cars is a real pain in the neck. And if I could own one and get away with it, I'd have one.
Which one? I
can't quite condense it down. I don't know. I think right now for me, some just where I'm at with and Luke being 2 and stuff, I'd have some sort of 911, I think.
Yeah.
I'd have to have something a bit more practical, but I wouldn't care about it in any way, shape, or form.
Yeah, they're like
it's a tricky question.
As close as perfect as it will get, right?
Yeah. Yeah. What do you think is the most undervalued car at the moment? What should be worth more?
That's a tricky one, because I really have my eyes on the Jeep brand, right? Because that's what I know. So I'm going to contain it to that brand, because, you know, everything else out there, I just don't have enough knowledge about.
Yep.
I would say 60s, late 60s Jeepster Commando. That's probably the ugliest Jeep that they ever made, but it's also because it's so ugly, it's got some character, you know. There is they made those in a couple of forms, like you can see there a few of them, like that teal that you have up there, that's like a half cab. That's really sexy, if you ask me. And then they made them with the full soft top, which is horribly ugly. And then the red one, down to the left with the lady behind the wheel. That one, or the one from a catalog up there. That's a really rare vehicle.
Yeah,
it's got an electric top, believe it or not, for the 60s. Which Jeep has not.
Oh, really? Wow.
I mean, there's no other Jeep up until whatever's available recently that has an electric top, that ever had an electric top. And it's got this Continental kit. And if you look through the catalog, the original catalog of that vehicle, there's probably 2 men in the catalog and all the rest is just ladies. It was really built for an audience that I think could relate to this nowadays as well. And I think we could, we have the plans of basically applying the same formula to the Vigilantes on for this vehicle. We have it for the Scrambler this year as well. So that's a CJ8, the long wheelbase. And my dream is to revisit the little forward control, the FC150 or the FC170s from the, again, from the late 50s, early 60s. That's one that's also, yeah, the finest example of a restoration out there. Is gonna, you know, it's gonna sell for what, $40,000, whatever.
Yeah.
So I really don't think that there's a massive market for it out there, but that's what my heart beats for, basically.
Yeah.
Little and FC, then I guess FC150. You need to look up. You will love it, I think.
And they're actually all in such amazing colors.
Yeah.
I feel like that's a very Jeep thing, just like fun colors. Like nowadays, everything is just
gray or black, or
white, black,
or red.
Yeah, incredibly boring.
Anyhow,
what's the most interesting car to you at the moment?
I mean, obviously Cybertrucks. You start seeing them around, and they're special.
Yeah,
right.
Have you seen any?
Yeah, they. So literally,
have you seen any in person?
Yeah, they drive around here now and then, and there's also the factory is not very far away from here, so we see 18 wheelers transporting them left to right. There's like five or six of them on there, and they're just driving around on 290 here by where we have the shop. So that's definitely special. Do I like the vehicle 100%? I don't know. It's like love and hate relationship. At first, when you saw it, it was really, you know, it's huge, right? It's really spectacular. Then whatever, it's special for the moment. I see a lot of, I was talking to my dad about this morning, which I think is really cool that there's such an audience for it. The Ram TRX, the 2024 Ram TRX. If there's one car, like a modern vehicle that I'd buy, I think the Ram TRX would still be, you know, on top of the list because, you know, it's still old school. 700 horsepower in a truck.
Yeah.
That's
crazy.
And literally, I brought my son to school 30 minutes away from here this morning. And I must have seen six of them on the road. So it's like.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Like that. I don't know if it's due to the area where we live in.
Yeah.
Or it's just, yeah, it's a cool car, whatever. So
it's like America.
Right.
Just like distilled into one car.
Correct.
The Ram TRX or Texas.
And then what I've learned
big
to appreciate.
Truck with a stupid amount of horsepower.
What I've learned to appreciate over the past, I'd say, weeks and months is the Rivian. I think they're really doing a good work at, you know, going a little bit outside of the traditional design standards. Yeah. I don't know if you've seen that little R3 that came out.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That looks wicked.
Yeah. It looks like a little Golf or a little Lada from back in the days, but totally revisited. And good for them for doing that, you know? Am I a big fan of the electric thing? Well, not really. But the car itself looks, it's beautifully designed. And the same thing with the wagon. They've just done a good job on that.
Yeah, Rivian, like, I don't know how many they've sold, how they're doing as a company, etc. But of all the sort of like electric cars, a bit like that, the Rivian, I look at and go, that's just really nice. Like they've done that well. And then the R3, I was like, ooh, like I'd have one of them.
Yeah,
like that would fit into my life quite well.
There you go,
five car garage, unlimited value.
I mean, I have it down there. That's my five car garage, you know. I build what I dream for. So I don't need anything else.
And they need a bit of road testing, so that's perfect.
Excellent. And it rotates all the time. You can ask me the question in a year from now. It will be, you know, same vehicles, just different colors, different.
Yeah.
You know, we geek out on them very individually every time. So yeah.
Yeah, that's a
pretty
lot of
nice
fun.
Life.
I hear a lot that the speccing and build process for most people is like almost the best part of the whole thing, like the continuous sort of journey through the build.
Yeah, absolutely. So the way we get this started is we have a discussion with the client. will define the terms of, you know, what it's going to cost, the timeline. And right now, I hate to say it, but we're nearly 4 years into new orders that are coming in. That's a little crazy, wow. But
it's quite a long time.
Yeah, it's quite a long time. And then we'll start rendering the car and sharing, you know, sharing those visuals with the client. That's really fun. I actually have a few of them.
Yeah.
A few of them here. There you go. So I start.
Oh, nice.
Rendering.
Yeah.
And once that's defined, it's full documentation. Every month they get pictures of, you know, where we're at, what we built. But that rendering basically also sets the terms of what we're going to build. If you want to change color throughout the process, that's something that we usually don't push for, just because, yeah, we steer it in a certain direction and we want to set that from the start as good as it gets, and not revisit it in the future.
Yeah. Cause I imagine if you change the exterior color, all the knock-on effects of like everything else that you would probably want to tweak,
correct,
interior details and whatever, it gets quite involved. Well, thanks very much for coming on the podcast.
Sam, it's been a pleasure. I hope you make it to Texas one of these days and we can go for a ride.
I'd love to come and visit at some point.
Yeah.
I need to do a bit of a trip, but it might have to be quite a long one if it's in the States. Cause
take your son with you. Large. We can get the kids to meet too.
Yeah. That'd be very cool.
All right. Thanks, Sam.